in a position to know. As the CIA's senior political analyst on Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War, and as a professor at the Army War College from 1988 to 2000, he was privy to much of the classified material having to do with the Persian Gulf. Here's what he had to say before the war, and I quote, "We're constantly reminded that Iraq has perhaps the world's largest reserves of oil. But in a regional and perhaps even geopolitical sense, it may be more important that Iraq has the most extensive river system in the Middle East. Before the first Persian Gulf War, Iraq had built an impressive system of dams and river control projects. In the 1990s, there was much discussion over the construction of a so-called peace pipeline that would bring the waters of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers south to the parched Gulf states and by extension to Israel. No progress was made on this, largely because of Iraqi intransigence. With Iraq in American hands, of course, all this would change." That's what he said. And to complicate matters even more, Turkey is just upstream building huge dams. And that's the kind of reason that CIA analysts predict that the wars of the future, the very near future, will be fought over water, not oil. Oil tankers will soon be found carrying a far more precious cargo. This water planet may seem flush, but fresh water available for human use constitutes less than 0.5% of all water on the planet. Worldwide, water is being used and polluted at catastrophic rates. Aquifers are plummeting. Over 1 billion people already lack access to clean water, and waterborne diseases are the most prevalent of all infectious diseases. Meanwhile, corporations are privatizing water, moving it from being a human right to a fee-for-service commodity in a kind of water apartheid. The word for Islamic law, Sharia, literally means sharing water. That's the inescapable choice we face. There is no substitute for water, and all life depends on it. The question is, can we share it equitably and also share it with respect for the needs of the rest of the web of life? Virtually all world cultures have long associated water with the sacred oneness of life. Water, the great dissolver, teaches us that we cannot finally separate ourselves from the environment or from one another. Around the world, people are rising up to protect water, this quintessential expression of our collective heritage. In many places, communities are stopping privatization in its tracks. And there are, in fact, sustainable alternatives that will rescue us from an impending global freshwater crisis, such as those presented here this weekend by the Water Stewards Network and the Water Doctors. This is the mission of Maud Barlow, one of the world's true visionaries working for water security. Maud is among the most brilliant and eloquent leaders in the global movement to resist corporate economic globalization and the privatization of the commons. She's a key member and director of the International Forum on Globalization, the Research and Education Institute, founded by the peerless Jerry Mander, that has gathered many of our most penetrating political minds into perhaps the world's leading think tank on these issues and to propose real alternatives. In collaboration with the IFG, Maud and Tony Clark wrote the book Blue Gold, The Battle to Stop Corporate Theft of the World's Water, now published in 17 countries. She founded the Blue Planet Project, an international civil society movement to stop the commodification of water. Maud's also the national chairperson of the Council of Canadians, Canada's largest public advocacy group with over 100,000 members. She's the best-selling author of 14 books whose topics range from public policy and politics to international financial agreements. But Maud's central focus today is on conserving and equitably sharing the world's waters. At a time when the commons is becoming increasingly uncommon, Maud carries water not for corporations, but for the peoples of the world and the web of life. Like water itself, Maud is powerful enough to wear down a rock over time with relentless persistence. Please join me in welcoming the unsinkable Maud Barlow.
You are so sweet. Wow. Hello, pioneers. Wonderful, wonderful to be here. Very, very honored to be on such an amazing panel with these visionaries. When I listened to Janine, I wanted to share with Janine and everyone here the words of Tolkien. J.R.R. Tolkien, who, of course, we all know has had an amazing comeback with the films. But he said, "The rule of no realm is mine, but all worthy things that are in peril, as the world now stands, those are my care. And for my part, I shall not wholly fail in my task if anything passes through this night that can still grow fair or bear fruit and flower again in days to come. For I too am a steward. Did you not know?" And to Kenny Ozzable, who gave that amazing opening this morning, I wanted to add another definition of fascism. This came from a very fine Canadian politician, believe it or not, who brought us universal Medicare, healthcare in Canada, Tommy Douglas. He used to say that fascism need not wear a brown shirt or a black shirt. Sometimes it wears a dress shirt, which is what I want to talk about today. When we think about the issue of water, or the concept of water, I just want to remind us that we're living in a closed hydrologic system. And not only is the water that we use the same amount of water that was here at the creation of the planet, it's the same water. So the next time you walk in the rain, just think that some of that water falling on you once was in the blood of dinosaurs, or fell from the eyes in the form of tears from children in the back of history. It's the same water. And of course, if we take care of it, it will be the same water forever and ever. But of course, we're not. Two very important recent developments I want to talk to you about this morning, and most of my talk's going to be a little more political than what we're maybe used to at Bioneers, but we do have a political confrontation that I want to talk to you about. The first development is the fairly recent recognition of the nature of the crisis, and Kenny just described it very, very well. But I want to urge us in this room to know that the crisis is beyond just pollution, and I don't mean pollution isn't the cause of what we're dealing with, or just the fact that so many billions of people in the world don't have access, because that's a social justice issue. But we're also talking about scarcity. And it's hard to understand in a closed hydrologic system how we could actually be destroying the water table, but we are. As we destroy the surface water of the world, we are now pumping groundwater far faster than nature can replenish it. And you can go to what scientists call the hot stains around the world, the Middle East, 22 countries in Africa, parts of this country, Mexico City, they're saying they may have to move. How do you move a city? You don't even know how many people reside there. And water is being used in totally inappropriate ways to fuel economic growth, or to fuel unlimited growth. And of course, that's the whole mantra of our time. And so you look at a country like China, it's taken its precious water resources of northern China, and they're using it to divert it so that all our running shoes and shower curtain liners are made in China now. And whole societies, whole systems are drying up. 400 of the 600 cities in northern China are now in water, severe water shortage. In fact, if you think of it, it's kind of like an apple that's drying up, but it's drying up in spots, and it's just becoming wrinkled. And that's how we need to see the situation. Now, the second very important development parallel to this is that water has been discovered by the private sector, long before most of us understood the extent and the nature of the crisis in which we're now living. A number of corporations around the world started collecting the ways and thinking of the ways they were going to cartelize and commodify the world's water, because those who control the world's water systems in the near future are going to be the most powerful among us. That's why I call water blue gold, both because, of course, it is precious to all of life and precious to all of us, but it has been discovered as the most important commodity to be bought and sold on the open market. And this is a parallel reality that we need to deal with as we understand and start to unravel the fact that when we exponentially remove groundwater far faster, when we mine it far faster than we can replenish it, or nature can replenish it, we know that it's going to be probably the site of many wars in the future. Now, we live in the era of the so-called Washington Consensus, that governments are abandoning their responsibility to their citizens, to natural resources, in the name of competition and unlimited growth. And as one famous environmentalist said, that unlimited growth has the same DNA as the cancer cell. It has to turn on its host in order to survive. But that's a system and a kind of thinking that most of our governments around the world have bought into big time. In this new world, absolutely everything is for sale. The seed deep in the forest, the rain before it falls, the fish in the water before they're caught. Absolutely everything has been commodified. And so the new mantra around water is commodify it, put it on the open market for sale, and let it be bought by the highest bidder. And what is at dispute now is whether water is a fundamental human right or a human need. And you may think that's semantic, but it's not. The World Bank says that it's a human need, and therefore it can be delivered by corporations. We say it's a fundamental human right, and you cannot buy and trade or give away a human right. Now, a handful of very powerful corporations have moved into the area of water, and I want to talk to you for just a few minutes about what kinds of corporations we're talking about and what types of privatization. There are three basic ways in which water is being commodified. The first is bottled water. We are putting a great deal of fresh water around the world in plastic bottles every year. Last year it was over 100 billion liters. I think that's about 33, 35 billion gallons of water, mostly in plastic, non-recyclable bottles. And we now have places like the Philippines that are receiving these. This is one of their growing industries in huge towering mountains of plastic bottles. There are fierce fights being waged all over the world as these corporations come in either to take municipal water, which is what Pepsi and Coke do, and they put it through a process whereby they discard two-thirds. For every liter of water, they discard two-thirds. Or companies like Nestle, which owns about 78 brands, including Perrier, and there are fights even here in North America around these companies. And they're coming in and taking ancient aquifer water, and Coca-Cola just got the contract, 100-year right to a whole water system in the state of Kerala, India. And they're telling the local people that they have no right to access that water. And this is I know it sounds insane, but you get to go into countries that are very, very poor and whose governments or municipalities are desperate for money, and they turn around and these companies are here. And let us just say this out loud, it is a form of mass insanity to allow so much water to be put in plastic bottles that destroy our environment as we allow our public water systems to decline. The second area of concern around privatization is the bulk export of water by pipeline, diversion, or tanker. Now, this is just in its infancy, but it's already started. Libya has already built a huge pipeline to take the remaining water out of the only aquifer under the desert, an aquifer that's supposed to be shared by five countries, and they've just taken it by force through building this pipeline. There are pipelines being seriously negotiated and discussed by these corporations from Scotland to England, from the Alps in Europe to other parts of the thirstier parts of Europe. Bolivia, one of the reasons that there's a civil war in Bolivia right now is that the government is not only going to send gas to North America, but they've agreed to sell bulk water to Chile because the mining industry there needs the more fresh water. And like many mining industries around the world, it's a terrible polluter. And of course, we in Canada are a tad nervous about the fact that you're running out of water in California and the Midwest, and we have very, very big reasons to have concerns about the water waste in places like Las Vegas, because we figure, and so does your president, that when you need it in the United States, you'll come calling for it. And I want to make a very clear statement here. This isn't about not sharing resources. This is about being able to make determinations about water use, ecological use, in a way that's environmentally sound and is based on need, not on the fact that some are going to get a hold of this and sell it to those who can afford it. The third area of privatization, or the one that's most moving most fast, is the whole privatization of the delivery of fresh water in municipalities and communities around the world. This is happening very fast. There are three major corporations. Enron got into the game, by the way, but this is one of the good byproducts of Enron going down is Azurix went down as well. But the three big players, Suez, Vivendi, and RWE Thames, are all European. And they are on a very, very aggressive move to cartelize the world's water sources. And they actually work with each other to say, I'll stay out of this area, but you give me this area. And they are actually dividing up the world very clearly. All three of these corporations are in the Fortune 100 top transnational corporations. Globally, their annual revenue last year was $160 billion. It's growing at 10% a year, outpacing the economy of many countries in which they operate, and they also employ more staff than most governments. Vivendi now has 300,000, this is Vivendi, just their water division, not their entertainment division, employs 300,000 people around the world. Now, their takeover of water systems around the world is absolutely well documented, and I invite you to join us in spreading this word, and I can share this with you through our website and so on, but it's huge profits, higher prices for water, cutoffs to people who can't pay. In many third world countries, they've actually taken the water and put it right out of the reach of sometimes the majority of the population. In Bolivia, when they privatized water, they actually said, we're also going to charge you for the rain that falls on cisterns in your wells and your roof. I do not make that up. You couldn't. Totally secret dealings, reduced water standards, and bribery and corruption. Now, it will not surprise you to know that then there is, of course, an set of institutional players that have come around to promote the privatization of the world's water. These companies are aggressively backed by the World Bank, the other development banks, and the International Monetary Fund. The majority of loans, in fact, in the last 5 years by the World Bank on water have been on condition that they privatize. But so contentious and outright hated are these companies. In community after community around the world, they are being kicked out. The local resistance is so fierce, from Manila in the Philippines to Buenos Aires to Atlanta, Georgia. Did you know that Atlanta just ended a 20-year contract after 2 years with Suez because for one of many reasons, the water coming out of the taps was brown. Because there's this fight back, the World Bank has just announced that it's going to increase its funding for these corporations. And don't forget, this is public money. This is our money. They're going to increase the funding for privatization of water in the third world from $1.3 billion this year to $4 billion next year. Shut up now! Tomorrow. Today we'll talk about this, and that's tomorrow's. There is a World Water Council that set itself up as a global high command of water, and they treat themselves and talk about themselves as if they're the kind of the United Nations of water, but in fact it's the World Bank, the IMF, and these big water companies, and they have established a World Water Forum every 3 years, which just took place in Kyoto, Japan, and let me tell you, we brought hundreds of people from all over the world, and we caused them such distress that, and we, at every single workshop, every panel, there was a panel of CEOs with all the heads of all the water companies sitting up on this dais with their, you know, $4,000 Brioni suits. And we had one after the other, our people from the Global South come up and hold up bottles of water, what water looks like in their communities after it's been privatized, and sent it up to the presidents of these companies and challenged them. Are you brave enough to drink this? And of course, the suits at the front were holding the bottles out like this. We caused major trouble. We got 90% of the media, and we actually forced the World Water Council to put on their website that, alas, there had been no consensus on water privatization at the World Water Forum. But water is also in trade agreements, and I want to urge us to remember to fight, continue to fight these terrible trade agreements. Water is both a good in NAFTA and the World Trade Organization, which means that you cannot put a limit on the import or export of this good. It is an investment in NAFTA, and if they succeed in extending NAFTA to the other countries of the Americas, it will be an investment in all of the countries of the Americas. Canada is being sued for $10 billion by a little fly-by-night California company because British Columbia banned the export of fresh water for commercial sale. And this company under NAFTA is suing Canada, and we think they've made a quiet deal because suddenly the company's gone very quiet and they don't have to publish this. This would be the model for the world if investment is placed in the WTO, which they're also trying to do. Now, both under the WTO, under the GATS, the General Agreement on Trade and Services, and through the FTAA, they want water also to be a service. And guess who's taken the lead on this? The European Union, who's taken a good stand on genetically engineered foods, but a terrible stand on water because it stands to benefit their three countries. So let me tell you about a success that you may or may not have read about, because I know part of Bioneers is to tell each other the truth about what we're up against, but part of what we're doing here is also to tell each other about our wins and about hope. And I want to tell you about what happened at King Cancun just a month ago when the World Trade Organization met. Now, this issue wasn't so much around water per se, but it was around life livelihood, and Fred, it was around the right of livelihood of farmers around the world. And on the very first day of the WTO, and you got a picture Cancun as, I mean, 37, 38 years ago, it didn't exist. It existed. It was an absolutely gorgeous, natural wonder of the world, and they thought, this is great, let's make money from it, and they've built these hideous, awful hotels. Some of them have 9 and 10 restaurants in one hotel, and, you know, the pools on every level and so on. And then there's a city of 700,000 Mexicans who basically look after them. Well, they barricaded that off so that the delegates from around the world could live in their five-star hotels and have their meetings undisturbed by the world's opinion. And they put up a barricade, and on the first day, 10,000 campesinos, displaced farmers from around the world, marched towards the barricade and took the barricade and pulled it down. And a farm leader from South Korea, there were about 200 fabulous South Koreans there. They were absolutely wonderful people. A farm leader named Lee Kyung-hai climbed up on the barricade and turned to face where the WTO was meeting, miles away, of course. Mr. Lee was wearing a great big sign that said, WTO kills farmers. And nobody knew he was going to do this. He pulled his sign up, and he took a knife, and he stabbed himself in the heart. And he swayed back, and we all watched. He swayed back and forth on the barricade, and he fell, and he died. And no one knew he was going to do this, not his family, no one from the South Korean group. They were absolutely devastated. And he did this. He left information that came out later about why he did this, and he said, my family farmed rice paddies from time immemorial. This farm was passed down. This was communal land. We took care of the water. We took care of the land. And they, under the World Trade Organization's agricultural agreement, we ended up having food dumped in here, and my land is now a shopping mall. They built a big tourist area because apparently it's very beautiful, and he's attended too many farmer suicides. There have been thousands of farmer suicides in India where people are fighting the twin issues of land and water. And the way they choose to kill themselves is that they eat the Monsanto's Roundup Ready as a symbol. They kill themselves with the pesticide instead of killing their land or their water. And Mr. Lee did this. His daughter was getting married the next week. That's how little they knew he was going to do this. He did this. He was a farm leader. He was not a nut. He was somebody who said, I don't know how else to say to the world, this is about life and death. It's about the survival of the planet, and I have nothing else to give. You got my farm. You took my friends. I've got nothing else to give except my life. And it became the symbol around which we organized all week. And I have to tell you that on the last march, we actually had an agreement with the authorities to allow us to take down the fence. The women went in first. Local indigenous women cut the first wires. There were 20,000 riot police, and they came up to that fence and they cut, looking at the police, closer than I am to the people in the front here, and they stood and they And we pulled it down, and then the last barrier was pulled down by the South Koreans. This had all been agreed on. And then we sat down. There was not one piece of violence. Every thousands and thousands of us sat in the grass. Thousands of us sat in the grass, and we shared, put down thousands of white carnations for Mr. Lee. And the next day, the Third World stood up to the, what's called the Quad, which is the United States, Canada, Europe, and Japan, and said, no. Well, you can't have all our resources, you can't have all the forests, you can't have all the trees, you can't have all the fish, you can't have all the water, you can't continue to impoverish our people. We have found ourselves. We are a roaring new voice, and we will not be put in this position again. A seismic change took place in world politics last month, and I'll bet you didn't read it very much in any of your local newspapers, because you know what? They don't want us to know that their system is failing. And that, when Kenny talked about those three stages, and the last being, you know, that, or one of the stages being fierce resistance, they're fiercely resisting us now. We're not cute anymore. We're a movement whose time has come. And they know it, and they're frightened. Water. We're on the cusp of making some very important decisions around water. More faster than most of us realize, water is becoming a cartel to be controlled by a powerful global elite. Unless we are successful in stopping this juggernaut in the not too distant future, water will be a commodity, and all decisions regarding water will be made on commercial, not environmental or social justice considerations. Now, this is not to excuse the way in which some governments have delivered water. We have not collectively cared for our water. But the answer to not good government or not adequate government is good government. It is not, and answering to the people and answering to an awakened population. It is not handing it over to transnational corporations who will continue to promote the corrupt governments that got them there in the first place. What we have to say in answer to the question, who owns water, is that no one owns it. It belongs to the earth. It belongs to other species. It belongs to future generations. It is a fundamental human right. It is a public trust. It is part of the global commons that we're going to carve out of these marketplace mechanisms, and is going to be one of the first places in which we reject the Washington consensus. And a water-secure future is based on the twin principles, the twin foundations of conservation on one hand and social justice or equity on the other. Cannot have one without the other. We're going to have to build a movement where environmental concerns come together with human justice concerns, and we say to one another that we, every human in the world, every plant in the world, every other species in the world, has the same right to this fundamental right to water. And when I remember standing in a place called Orange Farm in South Africa, and seeing for the first time water being piped to houses that have never had it, and they have pit latrines outside, and the worst poverty I have seen in my life. But finally, because they have water as a guaranteed constitutional right, there it is coming up to them. But there's, between the water and the tap is a state-of-the-art water meter put in by their government and Suez. And they cannot afford it, and now they have to still walk miles to get the water from rivers that are polluted with cholera warning signs. I say no. You know who we're working with? We're working with the South African Municipal Workers Union, who are the ones who have to put the meters in the daytime and come back and teach people how to take them out at night. That's who we're working with. Water is the sacred lifeblood of the earth. No one has the right to take it for profit. Until we collectively understand that, expect more resistance, expect violence, and I don't mean from our side. There's going to be police repression around this. Expect the resistance to get stronger, expect it to get global. We're having our first World Water People's Water Forum in India in January. We have just created the Red Vita, which is the first all-full Americas water network of people resisting water theft, and let's call it what it is, water theft. Expect the rise of a powerful civil society movement to challenge the Lords of Water. No one gave them the world's water. People and nature will take it back. Thank you. And on that note, we're going to take a break, and I'm going to ask you all to come back really for the good of the whole in 20 minutes so we can start again. There's coffee out in the lobby, bathrooms in both directions. See you back in 20 minutes. Thank you.
Of media coverage on the environment, survey after survey shows that the American public overwhelmingly wants more environmental news. Other than education issues and community events, interest in the environment consistently ranks highest. The bad news is that people need to learn a lot more. One benchmark annual survey that quizzes Americans on our knowledge of basic environmental issues found that when 2,000 people were asked 10 questions, the respondents averaged just 2.2 correct answers. Random guessing should have produced an average of 2.5 correct answers. This is the steep mountain that the iconic biologist David Suzuki has bravely chosen to climb. David has had a truly remarkable career spanning science, broadcasting, journalism, environmentalism, and human rights. As a communicator and educator on the environment, he is unparalleled. A superlative translator of complex scientific issues into comprehensible language, his beguiling storytelling has instilled wonder and reverence for the natural world in the hearts of millions. In 1979, he converted the success of the Canadian broadcasting company show Science Magazine into The Nature of Things with David Suzuki that continues today in over 30 countries around the world. He also did, among many others, the series The Secret of Life for the BBC and PBS. David's one of the most eloquent science writers in the world. He's a syndicated columnist, and his more than 30 books, over half of them for children, have consistently been bestsellers, including The Sacred Balance, Rediscovering Our Place in Nature, which recently aired as a PBS series as well. Destiny placed David at the birth of the genetics revolution in the early 1960s, and by the age of 33, he was a full professor in the zoology department of the University of British Columbia. He soon became the largest genetics grantee in Canada, made notable discoveries, and in 1976 went on to co-write an introduction to genetic analysis, which still today is the world's most widely used genetics textbook. And he's been very courageous as a scientist to speak out against the perils of genetic engineering. In 1993, he moved to the Sustainable Development Research Institute at the University of British Columbia, where he became an emeritus professor in 2001. He'd already founded the David Suzuki Foundation in 1989 to identify and promote science-based solutions to the environmental crisis and communicate them globally. A third-generation Canadian of Japanese origin, born in Vancouver, BC in 1936, David and his family were uprooted and incarcerated during World War II in a remote valley as part of the internment program. Turned loose as a child in that wild country, he bonded with nature and made a lifelong commitment against injustice and bigotry. He's always combined his scientific work with deep social engagement. David is truly a unique figure as a world-class scientist who draws elegant connections among the convergences of evolutionary biology, genetics, and ecology. But he is such a deeply beloved figure because ultimately he's been motivated in all that he's done by his contagious love of life, people, and nature. But David is doubly courageous as a serious scientist unafraid to merge science with spirit. That dimension of his work was deeply informed by his close relationships with First Peoples. In his magnificent book, The Wisdom of the Elders, he correlates the ancient empirical wisdom of indigenous cultures with contemporary scientific knowledge. And in introducing David, I'd like to share with you the words of Dennis Martinez, a Native American restoration ecologist who reflects a worldview that I know David shares on what it means to be fully human. And this is what Dennis said. Indigenous people have recognized that you can't control the environment without very serious repercussions. So ethics have been developed, which teach us that if we ignore the needs of our relatives in the natural world, we will suffer serious repercussions, because every animal and every tree has a spirit or a soul. As the elders say, if you take care of the plants and animals, they will take care of you. When you don't pay attention to them and you don't use them, then they get sad, the older people say, and they go away. That special kind of relationship was lost, but still, in every ancestral land, there exists a sacred geography. Few have been more dedicated or more effective in restoring that sacred geography than Dr. David Suzuki. Please join me in welcoming David. Thank you. Thank you. Well, I can't tell you how daunting it is to get up after the three previous speakers, who I think were all just absolutely wonderful, and I'm very proud that Maud is a fellow Canadian, and you can see what a great warrior she is, and I'm proud to follow her. Now that I'm in the last years of my life, I realize I've just been a one-note Charlie for the last 40 years, saying the same damn thing. So for those of you that have heard me before, here we go again. I'm going to make my remarks within the context of Canada, because I haven't lived in the United States for many, many years now. But you can infer the relevance of my comments for your country here. In Canada, for years, we've been bludgeoned by the mantra over and over again that the economy is the most important thing in our society. We've been told that we have to sacrifice for the sake of the economy, that we have to give up social services in our communities for the sake of the economy. So the economy in my society is seen as the source of everything that matters. I actually had a minister of the environment who said to me, "Listen, Suzuki, if we don't have a strong growing economy, we can't afford to protect the environment." And as a biologist, this has never made any sense to me, to say that the economy is the bottom line when there's a much greater reality, and that is that we as biological creatures live within the confines of the biosphere, the zone of air, water, and land where life exists. And it's the biosphere that gives us everything. You take this room, from the air you can't see to the glass, the metal, the plastic, the energy, everything has come from the earth. And when we're finished with it, we'll throw it back into the earth. So it's the biosphere that is really the source of everything that matters to us, including the economy. So I have, as a biologist, a very different bottom line from the one that we've been told over and over again we have to bow down before. And in order to explain what my bottom line is and try to convince you, I have to give you a bit of background. I was a junior at Amherst College because I was a biology student, I had to take genetics. And in my junior year, I fell absolutely madly in love with the elegance and the precision of genetics. So I decided then that I was going to become a geneticist. And in the fall of 1957, when I was starting my senior year at Amherst, I, along with people around the world, was shocked and electrified by the announcement that the Soviet Union had launched Sputnik. I mean, most of us didn't even know there was a space program going. And in the agonizing months that followed, some of you here may be as old as I am and can remember the rockets blowing up on the launch pad and getting off the ground and blowing up. We saw the American program, just in its infancy, fail again and again as the Soviets announced one first after another, the first animal in space, Laika, dog, the first human in space, Yuri Gagarin, the first team of cosmonauts in space, the first woman in space. And we realized how advanced the Soviet Union was in engineering and science. And so in true American fashion, the decision was made to catch up. And even though I was a Canadian living in the United States, I benefited. It was a wonderful time to be a student.
If you had a warm body and said, I'm interested in science, they threw money at you like mad. So when I went to graduate school at the University of Chicago, we were taught, and I believed, that science is the most powerful way of knowing, that through science, we push back the curtains of ignorance to reveal the deepest secrets of the cosmos. Through science, we acquire the knowledge to understand and manage the world around us, and life through science would get better and better. I believed it. That's what I taught my students when I became a professor. So I returned to Canada in 1962, and I was determined to be a hotshot scientist and make my name. Now, my field was genetics, and genetics was the ultimate descendant of the Newtonian paradigm that looked out at the world and saw the universe as a giant mechanical construct. He called it a clockwork mechanism. Ever since Newton, we've looked at the world as if it's a big machine. And through the Newtonian approach, we would look and focus on parts of that great machine, hoping eventually, if we could understand enough of the parts, we could put them all back together and reconstruct an explanation of the whole. That, of course, is called reductionism. And genetics is the essence of a reductionist approach. I was trained to study genetics in fruit flies. We didn't give a damn about fruit flies. We used to call them flying bags of chromosomes because we were focused on genes and chromosomes. So that was my beginning then as a reductionist scientist. I got my first grown-up job as an assistant professor at the University of Alberta. And I was ready to make my mark, and I got completely sidelined by a woman. And that's ever since puberty, that's happened to me over and over again. Usually disastrous, but in this case, one of my greatest regrets is that I never met her, but she had as great an impact on my life as any woman I've ever known. Her name was Rachel Carson. In 1962, Rachel Carson published Silent Spring. And as I read that, the message to me as a geneticist was, you guys are really clever. You can go in the lab and invent all kinds of things like DDT. But in the real world, everything is connected to everything else. So you may invent a chemical that will kill insects that are pests to humans, but because everything is connected, you're going to end up affecting fish and birds and human beings. And because of Rachel Carson, and the message to me, I was pulled out of the laboratory, and like millions of people around the world, was swept up in what we now recognize was the modern environmental movement. In British Columbia, the first issue that I got involved in was the American proposal to test nuclear weapons in Amchitka in the Aleutian Islands. And British Columbians felt that that wasn't right, that we should have been consulted. And of course, Americans were no different then than you are now. They said, to hell with you, we'll blow them up. And you did. But the important point was that out of that, Greenpeace was born in Vancouver. A lot of people don't know that Greenpeace is a Canadian organization that started in Vancouver in protest against Amchitka. We were swept up in protests against offshore drilling for oil in Heckett Strait, a mega dam on the Peace River at Site C, clear-cut logging in BC, and pollution from pulp mills. And those battles continue to the present day. In my mind, the issue was simple. Human beings were taking too much stuff out of our surroundings and putting too much toxic material and garbage back into it. So the way that you manage this is you set up regulations and you decide how much and what are humans allowed to take out of our surroundings and how much and what are we allowed to put back into it, and you enforce the regulations. So in addition to protesting and blockading, some of us were lobbying governments and saying, we need ministries of the environment. You know, before Rachel Carson, there were no environment ministries anywhere in the world. It wasn't even an issue until she raised the warning flags. So we wanted ministries of the environment. We wanted legislation to protect the air, the water, the soil, and biodiversity. And we wanted the infrastructure to enforce that. By the early 1970s, for me, it became crystal clear that this wouldn't work. And the reason it won't work was told to us by Rachel Carson. We don't know enough about how the world works to be able to set the limits. How could we have set the limits on DDT when Paul Mueller first showed that it was an insecticide in the 1930s. How could we have managed that when it was only when eagles began to disappear that biologists discovered the phenomenon of biomagnification? No way that we could have decided beforehand the regulation of pesticides in advance. CFC is the same thing. No one could have predicted the ultimate consequence of CFCs up in the atmosphere where ultraviolet would break chlorine-free radicals and scavenge ozone layer. Most of us had never known there was an ozone layer up there when scientists began to say CFCs were destroying the ozone layer. And exactly the same thing is going to happen with genetically modified organisms. We don't know enough to be able to anticipate what the long-term consequences will be. For me as a scientist, this was a very severe crisis. We're not going to stop science. We can't stop technological innovation. But if our knowledge of how the world works is so limited, how can we possibly manage the impact of our new discoveries in a way that will minimize the surprise? And for me, the change in how I looked at the problem began with my encounter with Aboriginal people on the northern coast of British Columbia. In the late 1970s, I decided to do a film about the battle over logging on the Queen Charlotte Islands, the land that the Haida people call Haida Gwaii. There had been a battle raging for many years, and so I flew up there and interviewed loggers and politicians and CEOs of forest companies, environmentalists, and one of them was a Haida activist who had led the battle against logging for many years. And I said to him, listen, you've got over 80% unemployment in your communities, yet many of the loggers are Haida. So, and a lot of the non-Haida loggers, they come into your community and they shop in your stores and use your barber shops and your bakery stores. They're adding value to your community economically. Why are you against the logging when it's good for your community economically? And his answer was very simple. Sure, they could cut the trees down and we'll still be here. But once the trees are gone, we won't be Haida anymore. We'll just be like everybody else. And at the time he said it, I didn't understand what he meant. And it was only weeks later when I was looking at the rushes back in Vancouver that I realized that he had opened a window on a radically different way of looking at the world. What he was saying is that the Haida don't end at their skin or their fingertips. That being Haida meant being connected to the land in a profoundly different way from our sense of looking at the land as a resource. That being Haida meant that the trees and the fish and the air and the water and all of that part of Haida Gwaii is what makes the Haida who they are. The land embodies their history, their culture. The very reason why Haida are on this earth is told to them by their connection with the land. And ever since then, I've been a student privileged to travel to many indigenous communities around the world. And even in the most impoverished, dysfunctional communities, there is a palpable sense of a need to remain connected to the land. Aboriginal people around the world refer to the earth as our mother, and they say that it gives us birth by creating us from the four sacred elements, earth, air, fire, and water. And that's what I've learned. When I talk in front of my Aboriginal friends, their eyeballs roll up into their heads and they go, what the hell took you so long? I mean, this is what they know from the time they're born. They understand this. Well, in fact, it's been what people have always known. Throughout time, people have understood that we were deeply embedded in the natural world and dependent on it. Our songs, our stories, our dances told of that relationship, our celebrating where we were, where we belonged on this planet, and our need to act in the proper way to keep the Creator's gift to us abundant and productive. We've forgotten that in a very short period of time, and now people like me have to rediscover it and learn from my Aboriginal teachers. As I reflected on the lessons that I've gained, I realized that we've framed the environmental problem the wrong way. There is no environment out there, and we're here, and we've got to regulate our interaction with it. We are the environment. There is no distinction. And what we are doing What we are doing to our surroundings, we're doing directly to ourselves. Now, this is not rocket science. This is the most obvious thing when you think about it. Maud talked about the continuity of water molecules, our legacy since the beginning of time. The same thing with air. You know, we don't think about air, but from the moment every one of us left our mother's body to the last gasp on our deathbed, we need air 15 to 40 times a minute. We breathe air deep into the most moist, warm, intimate parts of our bodies, and we fuse to the air. When you think of the destiny of the air we breathe in, our lungs are filled with about 300 million alveoli, these little capsules. We need all of those alveoli to make the surface area to come into contact with the air. If you flattened out all of the alveoli onto two dimensions, they would cover a tennis court. So that much surface area is all wrinkled up into our lungs. And then along lining each alveolus is a three-layered membrane called a surfactant. The surfactant reduces surface tension, so when the air comes into contact with it, it fuses to the surfactant. Carbon dioxide rushes out. Oxygen and whatever else is in that air is sucked into our bodies. The oxygen is picked up by red blood cells, and with every beat of our heart, that oxygen is delivered to all parts of our bodies. The point is, you can't draw a line and say the air ends here and I begin there. There is no line. The air is in us, it's fused to us, and it's circulating throughout our bodies. We are the air in the most profound way. And when I tell children that we are the air and that air isn't a vacuum or empty space, it's a physical substance, so what comes out of my nose goes straight up yours, they immediately go, oh. You know, I guess they think we've got a little bubble of air that's Mary or Johnny. Air is a substance that embeds us. The whole American notion that we're, you know, John Wayne riding in the saddle, rugged individualist, is nonsense. We're not separate individuals. We're tied together by the matrix of air that embeds us with not just human beings, but the trees and the birds and the snakes and the worms that are all using that air. And there's that wonderful thought exercise the American astronomer Harlow Shapley did many years ago, where he wanted to follow the fate of a single breath of air. Well, how do you do that? 99% of the air is oxygen and nitrogen. You breathe air in, and oxygen is what we want. It goes into your body, and much of it doesn't come back out. Nitrogen goes into your body, and some of it reacts biochemically and stays in our body. So oxygen and nitrogen you can't follow, but 1% of the air is an element called argon. And argon, if you remember your chemistry lessons from high school, is an inert gas, or what they call a noble gas. I guess it's noble because they're so snooty they won't react chemically with anything else. They don't want to touch those commoner elements. Anyway, argon is a noble gas. It goes into your body and it comes right back out. So argon's a good marker for the air that we take in. How many argon atoms are there in one breath of air? Shapley calculates there are about 3 times 10 to the 18th. That's 3 followed by 18 zeros. I say that's a shitload of argon. That's a lot of argon. So, all right, let's follow one breath of air that comes out of my nose. It immediately begins to mix in this room by convection, and within a few minutes, every one of you are breathing gazillions of argon atoms that came from that one original breath. But the door is open and there's leakage, and the argon goes out across San Rafael, across California, around the world. And according to Shapley, 1 year later, if we came back into this room, every breath you take has about 15 argon atoms from that one breath that we took a year ago. So on the basis of that calculation, Shapley says that every breath you take has millions of argon atoms that were once in the bodies of Joan of Arc and Jesus Christ. That every breath you take has millions of argon atoms that were in the bodies of dinosaurs 65 million years ago. And that every breath you take will suffuse the lives of all terrestrial organisms as far as we can see into the future. So air surely should be regarded as this sacred substance that gives life to us and that connects us so intimately from the past well into the future. Now, our great boast as a species is that we're smart. We're intelligent. Well, we're clever. But what intelligent creature, knowing the sacred role that air plays in the lives of creatures around the world, would proceed to use air as a toxic dump and think somehow it's going to be diluted away and everything will be fine. I calculate at my age that I have taken over 350 million breaths. That's 1 to 4 liters of air sucked deep into my body and filtered whatever was in it. The idea that we can use air then and it's going to go away is absurd. We are the air, and what we do to the air, we do directly to ourselves. And what grieves me today, you know, in Canada, not long ago, coal miners took canaries down in the mines in Cape Breton. And the reason for that, of course, is that canaries are hypersensitive to hydrogen sulfide or sour gas, which is poisonous. Canary keeled over. The miners didn't say, hey, Jack, come over, have a look at this bird. What do you think? You think they hauled their asses out of there as fast as they could go. That's why they took the canary down in the mines. Today, canaries are falling all over the planet. Plant and animal species that can no longer survive because of what we've done to the air. And we've ignored them. And now what has happened? Our own children have become the canaries, and we still ignore it. Today in Canada, 1 out of 5 children will develop asthma. When I was a boy growing up in the 1930s, we'd never even heard the word asthma. It was a disease that was so rare, the average person didn't know what it was. Today, you can't go into a class in Canada and not find all kinds of children with puffers. Our children are canaries and are telling us in no uncertain terms, we are the air, and whatever we do to the air, we do to ourselves. And the same applies. The same applies to water. We are water, over 60% water by weight. And the water we drink, as Maud showed so eloquently, is not just San Rafael water, it's not Vancouver water. The water circulates around the planet through the hydrologic cycle, so that whatever we do to the water, we're going to do to ourselves, and it comes from all over the planet. We are the earth because every bit of the food that we eat was once alive, and most of it comes, 98% of it or so, comes from the soil, the earth. We are the earth in the most profound way, and we are fire because every bit of the energy in our bodies that we need to live, grow, and move was once sunlight that's been captured by plants, converted into chemical energy that we then consume. We are indeed created from the earth by the 4 sacred elements. And as an intelligent, or at least a species that boasts of intelligence, it seems to me that that kind of knowledge ought to profoundly affect the way we treat our mother. And right now, we're not treating our mother in a way that is at all respectful. As I wrote about the 4 sacred elements in my book, The Sacred Balance, I was absolutely astounded to realize that the real miracle of life on this planet is, as Kenny said in his opening remarks, it is the web of living things, what biologists call biodiversity, that is responsible for creating, cleansing, and replenishing the 4 sacred elements. It was plants that created the oxygen-rich atmosphere that we have. Before there were plants, the air was absolutely toxic to animals like us. It's microorganisms and plant roots in the soil that filter water for us. In Vancouver, we don't filter our water at all. We get it from 3 watersheds surrounded by old growth rainforest, and I believe we have the best water in the world because it's life that's filtering the water for us. Life provides every bit of the food that we need to exist because it was all of our food was once alive, and life created soil that we grow our food in. Before there was life on Earth, there was no soil anywhere on the planet. And finally, life provides us with all of the fuel, other than nuclear, all of the fuel that we need, whether it's wood, peat, coal, oil, gas, all of that represents sunlight captured by plants that we liberate on burning. And it was life that created fire on the Earth itself. Before there was any life on Earth, there was no fire anywhere on the planet because in order to have fire, you need oxygen. So the miracle of life on this planet is not that we are created out of the earth by the 4 sacred elements, but that it is life itself that continues to provide those elements for us. Now, we say we're intelligent, What intelligent creature, knowing that biodiversity is the very source of our sacred elements, would proceed to attack the world of biodiversity as we are, tearing at that web in a rather frightening way? As I've come to realize then that it is our biological nature that creates the real bottom line. We are animals. And as animals, if we don't have clean air, clean water, clean soil, and clean energy and biodiversity, we just don't live, or we sicken. So those surely should be regarded as the real bottom line. Now, I find, especially in the southern part of the United States, this is a very hard thing to sell people. I was in Dallas a while ago, and there were a number of kids in the audience, and I said to the kids, now, if you remember one thing from my talk, remember that we are animals. Man, did their parents get pissed off at me. Don't call my Johnny an animal. We're human beings. We don't like to be called animals. And yet it is our animal nature that dictates the real bottom line. And once you can secure or ensure those basic needs, then it turns out that there is another level of need that we have that is dictated by the fact that we are social creatures. As social animals, the most fundamental need we have to be fully human turns out to be love. 1 minute. Okay. I can't cover love and spirit in a minute. I'm sorry. Let me end at that then. That we forget our bio. No, we've been on time, and I'm not going to be the one to wreck it. I want to thank you very much for listening to me, and I think that what we need to do is to get right down to what we are as biological creatures and realize that dictates our most elementary needs, and that we are social and spiritual creatures that we have to satisfy every bit as much. And then we begin to ask the important question: how do we create an economy? How do we create a society that is built on the protection of our real fundamental needs? Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.